RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with royal designers.
There can be few art forms more powerful and influential than music. My guest today's creative life was ignited by a passion for the musical explosion that surfaced in the late 70s and early 80s, spearheaded by the Sex Pistols and the burgeoning Manchester music scene with Factory Records. In 1982, he was responsible for what became a dramatically new way of presenting a nightclub venue, with the opening of the Hacienda in Manchester. It not only became the must-go-to place, but it also helped kick-start the regeneration of a badly neglected area of the city. With its factory-style visual language, featuring hazard stripes, day-glow colour, and utilitarian numbering, designer Ben Kelly had unwittingly stumbled on a completely new approach to interiors. 3 decades on, Ben has created spaces for both large and small projects, from the Design Council's elegant yet highly adaptable offices in Bow Street to the underground area for visiting children at the Science Museum, and also the highly successful gym box venues, a new concept of presenting health club. In between his interior projects, Ben Kelly has always produced work of a more personal nature, often taking his inspiration from the surrounding countryside of his Yorkshire childhood. He talks about this and more in this fascinating insight into his life and work. I first wanted to know how the now famous Hacienda project came about.
A woman called Lynn Franks, who was quite well known in the fashion PR business, I designed a shop for them on Longacre, which was one of the very first shops on Longacre after the wholesale fruit and veg market moved out. 1976, I think that was. And it was quite ahead of its time. It was kind of a hybrid thing. And it was quite particular in its design. It was my first commission, having left college. So I was able to sort of use ideas and materials that I'd had stored up in my head, in a sense waiting for the first opportunity to use them. Fast forwarding from having done that shop and having Lynn as a client, I met this guy called Peter Saville. Mine and Peter's memories is that we met in a place called the Zanzibar, and we got chatting, and it turned out that his then girlfriend was working for Lynn Franks in the basement of where Lynn had her offices. The shop was on the ground floor, so that was the link. And Peter told me that he had recently moved from Manchester to London, had been with Factory Records, and was now with a company called Dindisc, which is a record label as an offshoot of Virgin, and a band that had released records on the Factory label had signed to Dindisc, and Peter designed the sleeves of their albums and singles. And he had an idea for their first album cover, but he had no idea how to go about executing it. He had a concept, and his concept was to make a record sleeve using the least amount of cardboard possible. And as soon as he said that to me, I said, well, I know exactly what it should be. You should go and look at the door to the Howie shop, where there were perforated steel panels set behind the glass of the door. Off he went dutifully and had a look, and then we met again and chatted, and he thought it was a perfect idea. And so I then introduced him to the company that produced perforated steel panels, and we decided which perforated pattern, and eventually the album cover came out and it won a D&AD award. It was incredible. It was fantastic. And I just thought, I'd never designed a record sleeve before. I wasn't trained as a graphic designer, but it was a fantastic process. And I was interested in process and not print. After that, Peter asked me to design a single sleeve for a band called Section 25, who are on the Factory label. So I produced an architectural drawing, which was a 3D drawing cut on the 25th section, which with architectural drawings you do sections which are slices through a building. So I made the record sleeve look a bit like an architectural drawing after the band called Section 25, and it's printed on tracing paper like we used to do drawings before anything digital and computers. This was way before computers. That went on and won various awards. So this whole thing was amazing. So Peter and I built up this relationship. I got to know a lot about Factory Records. And one day he came to me and said that Factory wanted to open a nightclub and they'd asked him to design it. And he went and looked at the premises that they'd found and said, there is no way on this planet could I do such a thing, but I know a man who can. And the next thing, I found myself on a train going to Manchester to be met at Piccadilly Station by Howard/Ginger Jones in his little red sports car. We drove to Whitworth Street West to this kind of really run-down warehouse, and I met Tony Wilson, Rob Gretton, the manager of Joy Division that became New Order, and I think somebody called Alan Erasmus, who was another partner of Factory Records, and we toured the space, which was, you know, a fantastic, great big, as I call it, cathedral-like space. And after we'd finished the tour, Tony looked at me and he said, "Do you want the job?" I said, "Of course I want the fucking job." "Yes." "Great," he said. "Oh, and by the way, we'd like you to do an album cover as well." And there, and a whole bunch of other people walked in who turned out to be a band called A Certain Ratio. And when all that finished, I went and got back on the train back to London the same day with a job to do a nightclub and a record sleeve, which was just the most amazing day ever. And I was a one-man band at the time and working from an office off Old Street in a warehouse, sharing it with other designers and my then partner. And I thought, this is quite a big piece of work. And I was on my own. I'd been teaching at interior design at Kingston Art School. And fortuitously, one day, I saw somebody walking past the building who was an ex-student. And I shouted down this woman called Sandra Douglas and asked if she'd like to come and work with me. So she worked with me and kind of assisted me on that job. There's just two of us. And it started modestly. I think the client, they'd never commissioned anything like that before. They just thought it was like doing another creative piece of work. But what I thought was magical, and this is probably with hindsight, that the one thing that Tony Wilson allowed to happen was if he engaged with a creative person, be it a musician, a graphic designer, an interior designer, whoever, once he'd ask you to do something, he let you get on with it. And that's a huge rarity, but it is the most fantastic thing with any client. I think you get the best result.
I think what happens is that you become personally involved and actually become the client. And of course, you'd always want to do your very best.
That's a great way of looking at it. Yeah, I'd never thought of it like that before, but that's completely true.
Yeah.
But with that project, there was never any mention of a budget. The group of clients argued amongst themselves what the brief was and what their perception of the project. Is it a club? Is it a disco? Is it a bar? Is it a what is it? And my interpretation was it's all of those things and many other things besides. And it was so huge. They knew they wanted bands to play there, so it was a venue. They knew they wanted it to be a kind of a club where you had to be a member. And it was obvious that there was going to be dancing happening in there, that it had to have bars. So it became a kind of a hybrid. And really, there wasn't anything like it at all. But the precedents were either kind of Peter Stringfellow environments with mirror balls and yeah, and velvet walls or flocked wallpaper or whatever, or dingy, dark, black, stinking basements, you know, with sticky floors. And to me, this was an opportunity to like no other. And in a sense, it was almost like building a huge piece of sculpture. It was making a big artwork, in a sense. And there was a precedent with the work that Peter Saville had done with the albums, you know, that were quite groundbreaking. And there were no rules. Anything went. So I just set to and got on with it. And the more I produced, the more they wanted, the more drawings they said, oh, shit, it could be. But I think in the first instance, they thought it was just going to be a lick of paint.
Yeah.
That's what they thought.
But you built up this whole repertoire of visual language, which what has been termed, I think, a motorway aesthetic.
Yeah, that was a journalist, I think.
But that was so significant in that particular scheme.
Yeah, there was a kind of an industrial thing going on. And yeah, at that point in time, a description of high-tech design was something that was current at that time.
Yes, there was a very successful book.
There was a book, Lee, and that was really quite an influential book. So as I got to know what the project had to be, we had to build stuff, but there was a lot of structural work had to be done, which they had no idea about. And it grew and grew and grew, and of course the budget grew inevitably.
And presumably you must have learned an awful lot as you went along, and I think that was your first major project.
Yes, it was my first big piece of work, and it was a learning curve for everybody. So I describe it as a bunch of amateurs, really, learning as we went. But it was that freedom that was the great thing. That was the gift, I think. And the music on the factory label, all of the graphics that came out of that, I think I was wanting to just produce a three-dimensional version of that. And, you know, if I were to step back a bit, when I went to art school and I wanted to be a sculptor, I wanted to make sculpture, but I was interested in interior design. And in a sense, the Hacienda was a summary of both of those things. And it grew and it grew. So the industrial thing, out of from circumstance, because there were massive big structural columns supporting the roof of the building, which were right where the dance floor had to be, I had to find ways of thinking about safety issues. So stripes on painted on columns, I looked at the language of the industrial workplace and where the colour coding is used on different pipe works that's got different stuff passing through them as to identify them and hazard marks. And then, you know, we built a dance floor one step off the normal floor level. There was a hazard there. So roadside bollards were a solution to a problem to filter people on and off the dance floor, a very simple solution. But of course, a language was starting to, a design language was appearing out of this, and cat's eyes appeared, and industrial light fittings and kind of industrial heavy-duty materials to do with wear and tear and practical issues, along with colour and...
In fact, that very project was later reprised for the V&A exhibition, British Design from 1948 to 2005, and your Hacienda represented the 80s.
Yes, it did. And what was interesting about that was the clients at the V&A initially came to see me because they decided they wanted something of the Hacienda in that exhibition. And as soon as when all of the curators came to my office and talked about that and what could be done, you know, as a kind of a sort of a recreation of a bit of the Hacienda, as soon as I realised the bigger project, the exhibition itself, I told them how keen and interested I would be to be considered to design the whole exhibition, which eventually is what happened. Yeah. I was determined by hook or by crook to get that piece of work. So that was fantastic to have a bit of the Hacienda in the exhibition and to design the whole exhibition, because in a sense, the sweep of that exhibition covered my life.
Well, let's now wind back to your childhood. You were born on Friday, April Fool's Day.
Is it Friday?
In 1949.
Oh my God, that's really funny. I had no idea it was a Friday. Never.
And you grew up in the charming sounding Appletree Wick, which sounds a little bit Candlewick Green to me. Anyway, in North Yorkshire, near the southern part of the Yorkshire Dales. What was that childhood like?
Well, it was amazing. I was born in a place called the Pear Tree Nursing Home in Welwyn Garden City, in fact. My parents were living in St Albans. And when I was 6 months old, we moved to Appletreewick because my mother's aunt and uncle were farmers in the village of Appletreewick. Her uncle, my great-uncle George, was very ill and they needed help. So we moved up there and my mother ended up running the farm. She took it on and we moved into Lead Miner's Cottage. It did not have electricity. It had an outside toilet and heat was from, you know, a coal-burning Yorkshire range, an old fire. Electricity was put in quite quickly, but it was quite primitive. I don't remember no electricity, but I know that was a fact. And I went to the local primary school, of which there were 11 children in total. And that was made up of families of farmers, and there was a mill, a paper mill in the next village. So there were, you know, maybe three or four brothers and sisters, and brothers and sisters from another family, and me and another boy without brothers and sisters, making a total of 11 children. It was idyllic. It was fantastic. There was a beautiful river adjacent to the village, and we just ran in the fields and played by the river, and it was fantastic.
Do you have brothers or sisters?
No, I'm an only child. And in fact, in the village, I only had one friend. There were other kids, but they either weren't around. But when I was, I'm guessing, 8 or 9, a really interesting family came to the village and they rented an old farmhouse, which they eventually bought, and they became really good friends. And their mother ultimately became like my mentor. She was a really unusual, sophisticated lady from outside. It was as if I occupied a little kingdom in the Appletreewick and its kind of environs. My mother became a school teacher, but that wasn't until I was about 15 or 16. My father, who'd been educated at Trinity College Dublin, but had a nervous breakdown when his mother died when he was very young, and he ended up not completing his education, and then he went in the army, and he ended up working in factories. And he got a job near the Leeds and Bradford Airport, which was about 25 or 30 miles away. I think it involved him cycling and getting a bus and getting a lift and whatever to get to work. So that's where he worked. When I was 11 and passed my 11 plus,
So you were quite academic.
Well, I passed my 11 plus. However, I went off to the local grammar school, Ermistead's Grammar School in a town called Skipton, which was only about 11 miles away. But I was sent there as a boarder, which I never understood, really. Partly, I don't think there was getting there every day was difficult because there wasn't a proper bus service. I think it might have been possible for me to get there, but I think my mother thought I needed more friends. My parents were arguing a huge amount. It wasn't particularly happy that way. So off I went to boarding school, 11 miles away from home. But that was fantastic because I made lots of new friends and there were boys there from all over the place, some whose parents were in the forces. So I met people from different aspects of life and all of the day boys. I was hopeless at school, absolutely hopeless. This was 1960, I think I went to the grammar school. And at the end of the first year, you were streamed. I went straight into the bottom class. I had no interest in I was more interested in pop music. I was obsessed with it. It was when, you know, the Beatles had started and the Rolling Stones and all of that. So my interest lay in that. And I kept my own record of the Hit Parade. I did my own charts. I listened to the whatever it was on the radio. And I in my school notebooks, I drew all these charts and what records had entered and what had gone out, how many weeks they were in, new things coming in. And that was an obsession. And then I started buying music papers when, you know, NME and Melody Maker, stuff like that. That was where my interest was. And I got interested in what bands were wearing and what people looked like. Well, the truth is, when I did my O-levels, I passed one O-level. I passed art. They made me stay down a year. I got two. I think I got general science and geography. And they said, you can't go into the sixth form. And I left with three O-levels.
So you left at the age of...
Well, because I've been in the fifth form for 2 years, I think I left at 17. And it was like, what was I going to do?
Was that a O-level or A?
O-level, yeah.
So that got you into Lancaster School of Art.
So what happened was a friend of mine at school who'd left before me went off to art school. And I used to see him and he said, it's fantastic. There are no rules. You can grow your hair long if you want. You can wear what you want. There's girls, etc., etc., etc. I thought, this sounds amazing. But the art teacher at the school was quite unusual. If he saw anybody who had any interest or was good at art, he really encouraged them. And most unusually, three boys who were a couple of years ahead of me were all interested in architecture, and they all came down and they went to the AA from a northern grammar school, all as a group together. And he kind of helped and encouraged them, and he sowed the seed in my head really about art, and then this friend who went to art school. So I that's what I thought I wanted to do. Before that, probably as a result of my mother's influence, I thought I'll join the forestry commission. You know, I like trees, but that was a ridiculous thing. So in the first instance, I think I applied to Bradford Art School because I'd heard about David Hockney, and I think partly because of my lack of qualifications or whatever, they didn't accept me. And this is the bit that I can't remember and why, but I must have showed an interest in interior design. I know I did, because I think my mother discovered that at Lancaster Art College they ran some odd interior design course. So we got the application papers, which were filled out, and I went for an interview, and amazingly they accepted me conditionally because I didn't have enough qualifications to get a grant. You had to have 5 O-levels at the time, I think. So they said, we'll accept you, but you've got to get some more O-levels. So I went off to night school in Lancaster. And eventually, I scraped together enough O-levels to get a grant and to carry on. And I went, so I did my foundation year there, which was the most amazing eye-opening year of my life. You know, I'm sure everybody says this, the foundation course is just fantastic. And went on to this interior design course, which was 3 years. But I did 4 years at Lancaster Art College.
Yes, I think you went there from 1966 to 1970.
Yes, that's right. But what was happening, because it wasn't, you didn't get a BA at that time. It was a DIP AD, I think, was the thing, Diploma in Art and Design. So my fellow students who were doing different courses, whether it's painting, sculpture, graphics, whatever it might be, were all going off to other colleges for their further education. But I stayed at Lancaster because the course there was to stay at the college. And when I finished that, I became a house husband because we had a child. And for a year, I looked after a baby.
So you were married in 1970 at what, 21?
Yeah. And I spent a year looking after our child and getting my portfolio together because I decided interior design was what I wanted to do. I didn't want to stay in Lancaster. I couldn't see there was anything there for me. And the one person had got into the Royal College from Lancaster who was a friend of mine. So I'd been going down to London and getting a taste for that. And in that year, looking after our child, I was getting my portfolio together to apply to the Royal College and getting some help from a couple of old tutors from Lancaster, you know, getting my portfolio together.
If I remember rightly, the only interior designer that I can recall in the 70s was David Hicks for the Toffs and Terence Conran for the Trendy and G-Plan for Middle England.
Yeah. Absolutely. But I think I had a tutor at Lancaster, a guy called Ed Teasdale, who it turns out wasn't that much older than me, but he ran that interior design department. And I got to hear about Italian architects and designers. Joe Colombo was a name, and Archizoom and Archigram had started by that time. Mm. So through magazines, we saw this stuff, and I jumped at this stuff because it was kind of avant-garde and unusual and interesting and exciting. And it seemed to chime with the kind of pop stuff that was going on at the time. So art, music, design, it was a big kind of melting pot to me. And a chap called Max Glendenning, who was trained as an architect, but did a lot of furniture and also did interiors. And I'm pretty sure I saw his work in a magazine. We were saying earlier about the V&A exhibition, British Design. His work was in that exhibition. And I remember seeing in a colour supplement drawings that his partner, a chap called Ralph Adron, did of Max's schemes. And I saw them published, I think in a colour supplement, either while I was still at school or at Lancaster. And they were just really unusual pieces of work. And it just, these things hit me. And had a big, big influence on me. Yeah. All of my fellow students at Lancaster were all a bit veering towards a decorative stuff or really quite boring, aspirational stuff. And I was the one who was interested in stuff that was extreme and that was out there, that was, you know, new and exciting. But if I go back even further, I've tried to analyse this. In the village of Appletree, when the family that I mentioned moved to the village, the woman that became my mentor, Jean Williams, she was like a beatnik, but she was amazing. And she encouraged me every way. She used to have magazines in the house, and there were a few other. Appletree seemed to attract strange, eccentric ladies living in the village, all sophisticated and unusual. And my mum was friends with all these people, and I used to go to their houses and see magazines like Vogue and Harper's and Queen, even when I was quite young. And I flicked through them and I could see there was another world, a sophisticated world, an interesting world, a kind of glossy world that was considered. And I kind of felt the pull of this all the time from this tiny little village. And I think all of those things built up. And when Jean Williams encouraged me, and she built a house in Appletree, she employed an unusual architect. And all of this stuff was going in and I was absorbing the outside world, really.
Well, let's talk now about your time at the Royal College of Art. From what, 1971?
71, 74. I can remember going for my interview. We set a project. Hugh Casson and Lady Casson were running the department at the time. And I think I knew that what he'd done at the Festival of Britain. And it was just like, the biggest dream for me imaginable. I wanted to go through Royal College more than anything in my whole life. It was a way of getting to London, changing my life, building a new life. And I had this vision about David Hockney. I think I was down for about 3 or 4 days. There was an exam and an interview. And I learnt later on that they had a bit of a policy in the department at the time that they would accept people, and they always wanted one oddball in the year. And I think that I was the token oddball because the work that I had to show was kind of not, you know, I'd gone off and done my own art projects and stuff. So I was looking after our child at the time while my then wife was at teacher training college and living in this flat in Lancaster, waiting for my letter to come to hear whether I'd been accepted or not. One morning, there I was doing the washing up. Liam, our baby at the time, was in one of those weird harnesses that you could hang on a kind of a elastic thing and hooked around the door. So he was kind of hanging there. I heard the postman downstairs and I went down Royal College of Art on the envelope. There it was, and it felt quite thick. And I opened it and I just leapt in the air, started shouting and screaming. The kind of vibration of that our son started bouncing up and down in this harness thing because he got a sense of the excitement. And there we were, both of us leaping up and down. And that day my life changed, and it was, you know, in a sense, one of the most important days of my life. It was fantastic.
While you were at the Royal College, you got, I think, your first commission, and that was for the students' bar, the art bar.
The art bar. The name, which I named it the art bar. That was my idea. They've made a mess of it recently. But the thing about being a student doing interior design, you only ever see stuff on paper. So as a student, to actually get to do a built project, albeit the student's bar, was just the best opportunity. And I did it in collaboration with another student, a fellow student called Jeff Hollington. And again, we were able to kind of express ourselves and do a number, if you like. And at that time, Roxy Music had appeared on the scene, and everything about Roxy was fantastic to us. And the bar, I think, was really influenced by our perception of Roxy Music at the time. So the music thing was there, you know, in built into it. Mm. We also designed at least two sets for the students' final fashion shows, the catwalk shows. So we got to kind of build things, which we were really, really keen to do. And Jeff and I were great friends, and we tried our damnedest to make use of every single department in the whole college, whether it was printmaking, graphics, photography, fashion, furniture. We went through all of the departments we possibly could.
That was at a time when I think there was still a lot of interdepartmental collaboration, or perhaps that had ended. It certainly was the case in the 1960s.
We probably caught the tail end of that. But just one thing I would like to say is that the day I arrived at Royal College, I had this vision in my head that everybody's going to look like David Hockney in gold lamé suits and peroxide blonde hair. And I just thought, I was so disappointed. I just saw the most boring-looking students imaginable. They were product designers, furniture designers, whatever the departments were. I was really, really disappointed. I had long hair at the time. I went home, and that night I just got a pair of scissors and I virtually shaved my head as a sort of protest. A few days later, I was sat in the student canteen, and this group of students entered the canteen looking incredible, the most glamorous-looking people, and it was the fashion department. I thought, thank God for that. This is what I was expecting. And I then, very quickly, possibly in the first week, I found Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood's shop, which was then called Let It Rock. And I adopted my own persona. I started wearing crepe-soled shoes and fluorescent socks and tight trousers and short hair. And suddenly I had an image. And I felt very happy about that. And I kind of stood out from the crowd and wanted to, again, to express myself.
And it was through that shop that you got to know...
I got to know Malcolm and Vivian and ended up working with them. I just want to say, when I had done my interview at the Royal College, Hugh Caston was there and a whole bunch of others. And I was asked a question. Why do you want to be given on to have 3 years of postgraduate education doing interior design? That was a very specific question, and I had a very specific answer, which years afterwards I was embarrassed to even think about it, but then later on I realised it was exactly what I should have said. And I said, I wanted to see if it was possible to combine the art world and interior design to produce what I called art interiors. That was my answer to the question. I thought, God, afterwards, this is the most pretentious answer imaginable. But with hindsight, and I look back at some of the work out of the office, I think actually possibly I achieved that goal. It was all naive thinking and confusion in a sense, because I wanted to be an artist, I wanted to be a designer. I thought, well, I'll try and put the two together.
As we've touched on Vivian Westwood and Malcolm McLaren, I think you need to tell us about the infamous Sex Pistols Thames Jubilee boat trip.
Just to explain all of that, because I was buying stuff from Malcolm and Vivian, and I got to know them, and I went to the shop one day, and Malcolm, well, first of all, he looked at me and said, I've got a new group. He said, do you know what they're called? He said, I've called them the Sex Pistols. I think I reeled back in horror. I thought, I couldn't believe what I just heard. I could not believe that name. And not long afterwards, we were chatting, and he said, well, I've just taken these premises on Denmark Street for the band, the Sex Pistols, to have as their rehearsal space. It was a complete mess, and he said, I need somebody to do it up. You know, he knew that I did interior design, and I think I was doing the Howie shop at the time. Somehow I told him, I do interior design. And he said, could you make it decent for us? Could you make it habitable? And so I went to look at this place on Denmark Street, and I entered this corridor. The first thing I saw was some like graffiti on the wall, and it said, Throbbing Gristle. I thought, holy shit, I've heard about the Sex Pistols, now there's something called Throbbing Gristle. And with great trepidation, I banged on a door where I'd been told to go, and no reply, and I banged and banged, nothing happened. So I walked away, and as I crossed Denmark Street, I could hear a figure running behind me, and I turned around to see this person wearing a pair of Y fronts, ran across the road. Turned out to be Paul Cook, the drummer out of the Sex Pistols, and they were living there, so I went back in with him. They showed me the place, and it really was in a bad state, and so I made it habitable. I realised they were living there, and they had a space as their rehearsal room. And I just lined the walls with MDF and lacquered the walls with MDF, which is a product that had only just come out. About 6 months later, I was at a party and met John Rotten / John Lydon. And somebody introduced me to him. He said, you're the fucking idiot that did that place up on Denmark Street. He said, I've wrecked it for you. And I went back and basically he graffitied it all. He put all this graffiti. Years and years later, I went to look at it, and it had been taken over by Agnes B, the fashion label, as their offices. And all of the graffiti was still there, and they were really proud of it. I heard later on the radio that the powers that be, I don't know if it's somebody at the V&A, or somebody had heard about us, been there, and said, this should become a listed interior. And then I did two offices for Malcolm for his company called Glitterbest. And Steve Jones, the guitarist, asked me to do his so-called apartment in West Hampstead. So I did a number on his place. They were getting quite successful, and they'd signed to Virgin. They recorded the single God Save the Queen, which Malcolm decided to release and do a publicity thing on Jubilee Day. They hired a riverboat. I was one of the few people invited to go on it with my then girlfriend. My memory is that the band played very few numbers. A fight broke out, police launches appeared, and the boat was escorted to Charing Cross Pier. We were all told to get off. I remember seeing Vivian Westwood being dragged down the kind of gangplank by her hair by police. And I stood on the side. I heard a policeman shout, there's McLaren, have him. And they went for Malcolm, and I just saw red, and I thought they're going to kick the shit out of him as they were dragging him under the arch of the bridge. I ran forward to try and help him. Before I could get there, a policeman had his arm round my throat from behind. I managed to knock his helmet off, and I was thrown into the police van and spent the night in Bow Street.
Oh, wow. Well, let's move from prison cells back to the Royal College for a moment. I think it was cover of a thesis that you designed using embossed or etched lettering into metal that came to the attention of Peter Saville, who later used it for the cover of a single, Love Will Tear Us Apart.
It was a sheet of mild steel. Peter's favourite all-time word, appropriate.
But that connection with him, as you mentioned earlier, led to a friendship and opened up a whole new world of graphics for you. Before I forget, there was an amusing moment in the 1980s when you went along to an Andy Warhol book signing, but you went about it in a rather unusual way.
Well, I would say that Andy Warhol was a huge influence on me, as I'm sure many, many other people of my generation. And I loved what was the Silver Factory, which, after the Silver Factory, when Andy opened, moved the operation to Union Square in Manhattan, I was lucky to visit that place. So Andy was big on my agenda. And I heard that he was in town in London for the publication of his book, A to B and Back Again. I turned up at the book signing of the Arts Council bookshop, somewhere just off Piccadilly, and I went dressed as Andy. I had a blonde wig that I bought on Shepherd's Bush Market. I had kind of white makeup on my face. I wore clothes that Andy wore in the early Andy days. I had a little gold chain around my neck with an A on it. I had a pair of Andy-type glasses, and I took my place in the queue at the signing. I went there on the bus, dressed as Andy. And I had a copy of the book, A to B and Back Again, which I wanted him to sign. And when it came my place in the queue, at the front of the queue, where Andy was sat at this makeshift table with this other guy, Bob Calicello, who was the editor of Interview magazine, Andy's magazine, sat next to him. And Andy had this little tape recorder on the table, recording everything that was being said. Lots of batteries, I remember. I produced the book, and he looked up at me, and said, gee, what's your name? And like an idiot, I said, Ben. Why didn't I say Andy? Because there I was dressed as Andy. While this was going on, Bob Calicello nearly fell off his chair with laughter because he saw the situation. Andy really didn't blink. He was deadpan and he signed it to Ben from Andy. He drew a soup can. I got him to sign a couple of other things. As soon as I moved away from the desk, I was physically grabbed by members of the press, as it turned out, and huddled into a corner, saying, who are you? How long have you looked like this? What's going on? I said, well, I've always looked like this. This is how I look. But eventually I said, oh, no, I'm a fan of Andy and blah, blah, blah. The truth of the matter is I'd been to a fancy dress party a few weeks earlier where you had to go dressed as your favourite film star. I chose to go as Andy, so I had all the gear. But what happened after that was amazing. About a month later, one of the colour supplements came out. It was about a 6-page article about Andy's visit to London and the signing and the publication of A to B and Back Again. And the article went on about page 2 or 3 or something. It said, and this is quoting, they were in Andy's hotel room at the Ritz and Andy's English publisher burst into the room and said, hey, guys, did you see at the signing the other day? The Andy lookalike, where do you think his head's at? This was published in the colour supplement. I thought, I've made it, I've arrived. And it turned out I knew the guy who published the book, but he didn't know who I was.
Looking ahead a little, in 2 years' time, your company, Ben Kelly Design, will be 40 years old. It started back in 1977. Looking back over that time, you've clocked up an impressive body of work, far too much to talk about here, but I'd just like to touch on a couple. We've already talked about the Hacienda, but you then went on later to design Factory Records headquarters. And I think by that time the Hacienda itself had closed.
First of all, we did the Hacienda in 82. We then did quite a big project called the Dry Bar for Factory, really, which was kind of, the idea was somewhere for people who used to go to the Hacienda could go earlier to. But the thing about Factory was that they were extraordinary. I regarded them as almost like unpaid social workers. The site of the Hacienda was in a really rundown area of Manchester. It started to make a contribution to the regeneration of Manchester when they did the Dry Bar on Oldham Street, which had previously been the premier shopping street of Manchester, but was run down. The IRA bomb went off. The Arndale Centre got built. Oldham Street was in a terrible state. They took big premises on Oldham Street for the Dry Bar, which was a huge, huge bar, massive bar. It had the longest bar in Manchester. It was the first bar in the UK of its kind, and it became copied. And I hate the expression designer bar, and I virtually feel responsible for creating that phenomenon. You know, it served food and there was a kind of sophistication about it, and the model that I looked was more towards Europe and cafes where you could have really good coffee and read the newspapers, have a croissant, have a glass of wine, but also endless types of beer, etc. So there was a kind of sophistication and an ambition for it, and it set a new model for bars. It really, really did. So that was the second project. And then the third one was their headquarters building. They'd previously been operating out of a flat in Didsbury. The Happy Mondays were having huge success at the time, but it all started to go wrong for Factory and they overstretched themselves. They bought the building that became the headquarters without even going inside to look at it. I don't think they had a survey done. We virtually had to rebuild an entire building. That was a very big, big project. They overspent, things were going wrong. Eventually they went bust.
Did that mean that you lost money?
We did lose some money on the factory building. And then even after that, Tony Wilson, we designed his loft apartment. I have an anecdote. When we were doing the Hacienda and the Dry Bar, I used to be travelling to Manchester regularly. After we'd finished the three Manchester projects, I didn't go back for about 10 years. And when I went back on the train and I got off at Piccadilly Station, I thought I'd gone to the wrong city. It was transformed. It was as if in the previous years, everything was in black and white. It was still a grimy, industrial northern city. When I went back 10 years later, it was as if someone had pulled a big switch and everything was in colour.
Do you feel a little responsible for that?
I know for a fact that Manchester City Council and the RIBA, they produced a big book about Manchester, and there's a timeline in there. The first entry in the timeline is the formation of what became the Manchester City Council. The second entry is the date that the Hacienda opened. It's a fact of life that the Hacienda is acknowledged as beginning the regeneration of Manchester. And Factory did that. They went where nobody else would go in rundown areas, and regeneration followed them because of who and what they were. And it set a kind of a pattern. It's almost like the Bilbao effect with Frank Gehry's thing.
Another of your projects, certainly a particular favourite of mine, was the Design Council's offices in Bow Street. Sadly, no longer there, but it was an incredibly flexible space filled with light and colour, wood and wit. You nodded to its former use as a telephone exchange by introducing telegraph pole lights. That project seems to sum you up, sort of functionality with a twist, which works so well.
Really, really great to hear, and thank you. Well, what I would say there is that I see certain projects that we've done as big stepping stones, and the Howie shop was the first stepping stone, and Seditionaries, Malcolm and Vivian's shop Seditionaries, which I can only claim to have done the frontage of, but that was an important thing.
And then you produce that great space in the basement of the Science Museum, a sort of hacienda for kids.
Well, that was Tim Malloy, who was the design director there, and he did whisper in my ear before we got the job, it'd be great if you got the job, you could do a hacienda for kids. That was a piece of magic to me, and that made me, I would have killed people to have got that job. So we went all out and we were lucky to win it. That was a massive stepping stone. And what I say about that is that all the work that I'd done prior to the basement at the Science Museum was for either friends or like-minded people or what I, wackos, eccentrics, weirdos, all sorts of unusual, great, great visionary people. I described it a bit like being on the perimeter of the pond, throwing pebbles into the middle and the ripples coming back out. With the basement at the Science Museum, this was for a national institution, a government-funded project. Suddenly, it was serious. It wasn't the music business. It wasn't nightclubs. It was for the Science Museum in London, in South Kensington, in the Royal Borough.
It was for everyone.
It was for everyone. That, to me, suddenly we were working for the establishment, and I thought, now we're in the middle of the pond and we can work back out. Suddenly I thought, this is where I want to be. I want to be doing work in the public environment that affects everybody's lives, and it wasn't just kids liking music or on the periphery, it was bang in the middle. And I could still, and because Tim had said that great thing about a hacienda for kids, I could still bring the same language to it, have the same attitude about it and the same approach. And in a sense, designing the basement was very similar to designing the hacienda. I remember my mindset was the same on both those projects. And from that to be doing the Design Council offices, these were the sort of projects that I really wanted the office to be doing. There were other projects that came along that we weren't successful with. And I found, next thing, we were competing against big architectural practices.
Following on from that, you produced the highly individual interiors for Gym Box. These are often located in difficult spaces, like the old Lumiere Cinema in St. Martin's Lane. And for a while, you were the go-to person who would take on spaces, I think, that nobody else wanted.
There's a story there. With those gyms, our client, who's one individual, kind of discovered almost a phenomenon that there are loads of spaces in London, mostly below ground, that nobody else wants. Usually people want them as nightclubs or bars, but they can't get licenses. But you can put gyms in them. But one day I got a phone call from this guy who said he wanted to open a nightclub and blah, blah, blah. Went to meet him and he told us this story. He'd been in the advertising world, gone to New York. He was working in New York. He used to go to gyms in New York and there were a few unusual gyms there. And he thought, I could do a gym in London, because at that time they were all clean, aspirational spaces. So we met with this guy, Richard, and he told me that he'd trawled London looking for his designer, and eventually he found the person he thought was just right for the job. And this person produced his scheme, and he came along to the client meeting and told our guy that became our client, what we're going to do, Richard, I've had this idea, we're going to make the gym look like the Hacienda nightclub. What a dick, what an idiot. Of course our client thought, hold on a minute, what? I find the person who did the Hacienda nightclub. He shot himself in the foot and we got the phone call. And so, as with the basement at the Science Museum, the first thing I wanted to do was to paint stripes on columns there as an acknowledgement back to the Hacienda. Similarly, we did a version in the first Gym Box. Yeah. And they've gone on and we've developed that. And they changed the face of health clubs. Yeah. And they are almost more like nightclubs. They have DJs in them. Mm. They have unusual classes. They have bright colours. It has. It's changed the face. As with the Hacienda, it changed the face of nightclubs. Basement was a different way of having a museum environment. And with health clubs or gyms, as we call them, every gym has a boxing ring in it.
There's one more Hacienda connection, and that's the film 24-Hour Party People with Steve Coogan, which for you could have been great, but actually it wasn't. Tell us what happened.
As all these things happen, you get a phone call, don't you? That's what happens. Can't remember who it was that called me, somebody involved with the film, and he outlined what they were doing and said that they were going to rebuild the Hacienda as a set. I thought, your timing is really bad. It was only about a few months earlier that they knocked the building down. They could have used the building. So, could I help them? I said, yes, I could help. I've got all the original drawings. I have everything. I'm kind of a bit of a hoarder. So I'm very happy. And then they said, would I take part in the film, and would I sign a living person's release form playing myself in the film? I'm like, oh, my God. So I was saying yes to everything. Another phone call and another phone call. And I knew about Michael Winterbottom's films. I thought he's a great filmmaker. And I was thinking, well, I'll become some kind of consultant. I don't know, maybe it's the fourth or fifth phone call. I said, well, there will be a fee involved for this. As soon as I mentioned a fee, they disappeared off the face of the earth. They just disappeared. Months and months later, I started getting calls from people in Manchester saying, God, we've seen, they're building this set and it's incredible, it's fantastic. And I thought, how are they doing this? Fast forwarding again, I think I got an invite from the production company to go to a filming session in the rebuilt club for a particular sequence of the film, and for some reason I decided against it because I thought, I'm really pissed off here that they've gone ahead anyway. So eventually the film came out, and I had to pluck up courage to go and watch it, because I'd heard all sorts of secondhand stories coming back from Manchester. I'd also spoken to Peter Saville about it, who was really upset because there was a role for him in the film, and they'd got an out-of-work actor to play him who was working as a waiter. And I think Peter was he wanted a big star to play him. Anyway, that's another story. So I went with a whole group of people, maybe 8 or 9 people we went. I was kind of protected by this bunch of friends. And I sat and watched the film. Excuse me. I was amazed. I thought, as a set, the first instance, I thought... they must be using old footage from the club. It was so perfectly done. I was amazed, absolutely amazed, apart from thinking the film was really funny and enjoying it. So I was really confused and started looking around on the internet and blah, blah, and listening to people's stories. And then again, talking to Peter, he said, there's a copyright issue here. Bottom line was, I took about 3, if not 4 years legally. I went to first lot of lawyers who were hopeless, and one day my now wife was somewhere and she met a guy who was a training to be a copyright lawyer with a firm called Mishcon de Rea. I went straight to Mishcon de Rea, who were red hot for it because, there was a bit of publicity involved, and they did it on a no-win, no-fee situation. So we hounded and hounded. Michael Winterbottom's film just stonewalled us, and we couldn't find an address for them even. It was as if they were invisible. And eventually, it ended up with the distributors of the film who settled out of court. And it was the most... I went on a kind of mission. I thought, as a designer, my copyright has been infringed here. They've really taken the mickey. He's a creative person. They should... I'd have been happy if they said, here's £500, you can have all of the drawings, I will advise. They managed to do it without. They found stuff on the internet, and I thought, right, I want this to be all over the design press. I wanted to stir it up in the design press, make them look like fools, and that they've been insulting as creative people, treating other creative people disrespectfully. And copyright is a red hot potato. It's really tricky in my business because it's hard to define where it is. But by the time we got to the end of it, I was so exhausted I just could not think, right, I'm now going for the press. I was just too exhausted. It was depressing.
Oh, dear, that is a sad one. We're nearing the end, but just before that, another more personal aspect to your work is, for want of a better word, art projects. And in recent years, you've been drawn back to the landscape and the sort of interventions made by man. By that, I mean dry stone walls, stiles, 5-bar gates, directional signs, walking sticks. Is this something you've always done? Connecting with your Royal College statement, the sort of blending of art and interiors. And I might add, you've also made a coracle, which are those beautiful lightweight boats that you can carry on your back. Tell me about this more personal side of your work.
I guess from my early upbringing in Appletreewick and early thoughts and early influences and things that were going on there, that those things don't ever leave you. More recently, 8 years ago, we were lucky enough to be able to buy a cottage down on the south coast, a Coast Guard cottage, which had previously been owned by Faye Godwin, a landscape and portrait photographer. Yeah. It was her cottage, and she built a studio behind the cottage where she had a dark room and her kind of work studio, which I now have, is mine. And the landscape down there, which is in this place called Pet Level between Rye and Hastings, there are sort of marshes, so it's very, very flat. Where I grew up, it was, you know, hills and mountains and fields and dry stone walls. Down at Pet Level, it is polar opposite to where I grew up, and it's flat and big skies and wooden stiles. And I got interested in the notion of thresholds and demarcation and how the land is divided up and the kind of politics of that and the right to roam and what paths and where geography, where maps, all of that stuff. And I think having Faye Godwin's place sort of got me going again, thinking about all of those things. I've always been interested in collaboration. So from day one, starting work professionally, the process of what we do is by its nature collaborative. You know, there's always a team of people that you work with, either in the office or other different consultants. And some jobs, you know, there might be an art side to it. And I've started to collaborate with other artists, I've collaborated with other designers, either by choice or by necessity. And I've encouraged that in the office. As I've got older, I've been interested in producing what I call my own work. And I'm interested in the idea of craft, but not for craftiness' sake. And I have a thing recently about interior design. I've engaged on this project with interior design, dead or alive. I'm concerned that the discipline is a different discipline now. It's been hijacked by big agencies, and it's very thin, it's superficial, it's all about lifestyle and branding. So I believe the craft of the discipline has been lost, in a sense. So whether it's making a coracle where some craft is involved, or building a dry stone wall where craft is involved, or a gate, whatever it might be. So I like this crossover, the idea of crossover and blending disciplines, and somehow an ambiguity about where something starts and where something stops. So I think these kind of side projects is an outlet for me to kind of investigate all of those kind of things and the natural world, which is about as far away from Andy Warhol as you could get. But the 1-5-bar gate thing that I did, where I was using branding techniques and inlay and stuff, I got symbols from everywhere, you know, and set them into this gate, this old gate which I had rebuilt and recrafted, if you like, and that's hung in exhibitions that I've done. So there's kind of inlay of a dog jumping over a gate, which is from a photograph of Faye Godwin's. There's a dollar sign, there's a pound sign, there's a bit of the Bayeux tapestry, there's a victory sign, there's Ubu Roi, Apollinaire's Ubu Roi, there's Duchamp stuff in there. There's this kind of mashup of imagery from cultures and history on a 5-bar gate, almost like graffiti, to try and make some kind of narrative and comment on society and what the symbolic stuff that we've used and look at. You know, this is something that I enjoy doing. To find a platform for this work is difficult. But I've been lucky enough to have a couple of two or three of my own shows at various places and collaborative shows and stuff in my office, the collaborative work that I've done with an artist called DJ Simpson. And they're like ongoing dialogues, and they're investigating process and materials and ideas. The Coracle collaboration with Michael Marriott. From my childhood, my father's from the north of Ireland. We used to go to Ireland every year, to the west coast of Ireland. I would see farmers with coracles, putting a sheep in a coracle and rowing to an island for grazing. I saw coracles in an exhibition, and I thought it'd be fantastic to make one. And Merritt's a friend, and he had the facilities, and we made these two coracles together. Mine turned into a bit of a hacienda coracle, and Michael's, the seat of his, was from his grandmother's wardrobe, a bit of his old wardrobe. And we launched them on Robin Levine's lake.
Strangely, in some quarters, craft is rather frowned upon these days, which I find crazy.
Indeed, but I do think there's a new breed of people who they have a different view. They are craft based, but I think, you know, they have other ideas that they bring to it that make it not just what the Crafts Council used to produce. I'm not want to be bad mouthing anybody or anything.
Well, with all that experience behind you, what advice would you give to a budding Ben or Bernadetta Kelly, who's just starting on their journeys?
Well, first of all, I want to underline the fact that the work in the office is all collaborative work. It's got my name on it, but it is not, I've pulled back from the office quite a lot now, and, people in the office, I think we've created, you could call it a handwriting, I don't like the word style, and it can be produced. It doesn't have to be me producing it. It has its life. The first advice that I give to students is use peripheral vision. I worry about people who go around with blinkers on and they just see what's in front of them. And I've always said you need to know what's happening way over that side and what's happening on that side, and you somehow then bring it together in your head and view things as broad as you possibly can. I worry about education. There's too many students doing too many courses and there's not enough jobs and they come out with debt and what the hell do they do? It's a problem. It's a huge, huge problem. And I've taken on a big role at UAL in interior and spatial design. And that's where this idea of interior design, dead or alive, has come from. That it's questioning the status and the nature of the discipline at the moment. And I did a big seminar last March and I did work with students about that. And had lots of speakers on the subject, and I'm now looking for the next stage of that kind of campaign, if you like. You just have to go for it. You have to push. You have to look where the opportunities are. Look in corners where you might not think there's something going. Meet as many people as possible. Talk to people. Get your thoughts and ideas from the broadest range of places. And but then I suppose you have to channel it into something that has some rigor to it.
Well, I think there's a great deal of very valuable advice there. Ben Kelly, thank you.
That's my great pleasure, Mike. It's a privilege to talk to you. The way you've done your homework is fantastic.